From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
You're the top. You're the Colosseum. You're the top. You're the Louvre Museum. You're a melody from a symphony by Strauss. You're a Vendel bonnet, a Shakespeare sonnet, you're Mickey Mouse.
For generations of Americans now, Cole Porter is the top when it comes to American songwriting. As the song says, he's Mahatma Gandhi, Napoleon Brandy, the National Gallery, Garbo Salary. He was a giant on Broadway, a risque sophisticate in popular song, an inspiration to Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, Fred Astaire, Louis Armstrong, Lena Horne, to anyone who sings. Born to money in Peru, Indiana. Schooled at Yale and schooled in life in Paris, he wrote of high society and low, of love and ladies and gents and Pepsodent. A new volume calls it poetry. This hour on Point, the life and lyrics of Cole Porter. You can join the conversation. Does Cole Porter still take you to the moon on gossamer wings? Is it poetry? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is musical theater historian Robert Kimball. For 41 years, he's been the artistic advisor to the estate of Cole Porter, and what an estate that is. He's edited several books on the master. The latest is the new Cole Porter Selected Lyrics, part of the American Poets Project. Robert Kimball, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's a great pleasure.
It's terrific to have you. And here, I mean, it's a rough world out there. We're ready for a little refuge with Cole Porter. And here he is being put in this series in the company of Walt Whitman and Edma St. Vincent Millay and Edgar Allan Poe and right on down the list of great American poets. You've worked with Cole Porter's work for many, many years. We know he's a lyricist. We know he's a great songwriter. Is he a poet?
It's hard to decide that, but I think we make the case that he should at least be considered as a poet. His language is poetic. His songs are memorable. They stay with us and endure much more than a lot of the poetry which has come and gone. So, in a sense, if poetry is about remembering shared experiences, yes, certainly.
The scale of this man's work is astounding. More than 800 songs at his hand, show after show after show on Broadway. He didn't start early with the celebrity and fame that ultimately came to him, but just give us a sense of the scale, the sort of march out for us, the sort of top of the mountain range of Cole Porter's work.
Well, the career as we know it is about 50 years. His earliest surviving songs are from about 1910, and his last were from the late 50s before his leg was amputated. So he wrote, and of course we don't have everything. We have what we have, and what we have is pretty fabulous. He wrote for Broadway, for London, for Hollywood, and he did it with great joy. And he loved to write. He did not have money worries, so he didn't have to scramble. And that perhaps was one reason why it took him longer to achieve the top of his profession.
His grandfather, an Indiana man of great wealth, came back from the California Gold Rush, I read, with money and built on that. Cole Porter sent off to prep school, what was it, the Worcester School in Massachusetts?
Yes.
And then Yale, and then very early to Paris as World War I unfolded. When did he start songwriting?
Well, he certainly was writing while he was in prep school at the Worcester Academy. He used to write parodies of the teachers and his fellow students, and he wrote songs which do not, alas, survive. But when he was at Yale College in the class of 1913, he wrote several musical comedies. He wrote specialties for the Glee Club, of which he was president, and they toured the country in a private train. He was a big star on campus. He wrote the great football songs for Yale, Bulldog and Bingo, which are still sung lustily at all football games.
It's my alma mater, Bulldog, Bulldog, Bow, Wow, Wow, and there's Cole Porter writing it, of all people. and then on he goes. That time in Paris, as much of his life, sort of given to lots of legend and even fable, he wasn't shy about sort of making up what he did. What were those years like for Cole Porter?
Well, certainly there's a lot of myth about his European days. A number of people have this sense that he joined the French Foreign Legion, which he sort of technically did. He was attached to it, but he didn't ride through the desert you know, on the back of some animal carrying him and his piano
through
the wars and the sandstorms.
Right,
no,
right.
And he didn't do that. He tended to pick up and purchase a lot of uniforms of different armies and parade around in them in the Paris streets. And
that's a different thing entirely, I think.
Yes, that's another kind of processional. But he was always writing. He wrote all the time, mostly at night, and he wrote to please himself and his friends as much as to try to become successful. And he was the only American composer, certainly from the musical theater world, who was part of the lost generation, the generation of people like Hemingway, who went overseas and were involved in World War I, either driving ambulances or being part of the war effort. Porter did relief work and drove an ambulance, came from the Midwest, they all did, and then returned to America, which he did, really starting in the late 20s, but for good at the end of the 30s when the war broke out in Europe.
I want to keep these lyrics and songs in our ear as we look at Cole Porter. 1928, the musical Paris, and the great unforgettable Let's Do It, Let's Fall in Love. I mean, risque like crazy, but double entendre that shielded it. Here's a version sung by Louis Armstrong. Let's Do It, Let's Fall in Love.
And that's why boys do it. Bees do it. Even educated fleas do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. In Spain, the best upper sets do it. Lithuanians, and let's do it. Let's do it. Mama, let's fall in love.
Robert Kimball, pick this one up for us as an example. I mean, so much of Cole Porter is right here. The sexuality, the double entendre, the lists. I mean, he loved songs with lists and wrote a lot of them. Take us into Let's Do It.
Well, certainly the word mama was added by Satchmo in his incomparable performance.
Yes.
But this was a Liszt song which was in its first chorus about nationalities and places. It didn't begin birds do it, bees do it. If you notice, the Lithuanians and Let's come along, and then later there's something that should appeal to you that people say in Boston, even beans do it.
Right, but it got a little PC cleaned up here. It began, that's why chinks do it, Japs do it. That's gone when Louis sings it.
That's right. And that went pretty early, but on the very first recordings you hear it, and it, of course, got changed, and political correctness, as it should have been, I suspect, from the beginning. But if we tried to rewrite that lyric and come up with some other nationality to match the Lithuanians and the Letts, we would have our hands full, wouldn't we?
Yes, we would. It's almost
so birds do it. Yes.
Birds and
but
bees.
But that was a great... Yeah, the song is the turning point in his career. It is the song that puts him on the map as a great writer with a distinctive individual voice, writing about sex candidly, writing an adult love song. And his voice was then, from then on, heard all through the world.
Talk
That's
to us
the
about
song that did it.
The sexuality is just rippling here, and it ripples in a lot of his songs. It was actually pretty straightforward. Cole Porter was gay and flamboyantly gay and rich enough not to worry about it, but he was married to Linda Lee Thomas, a sort of prominent socialite he met in Paris, divorcee, rich herself, and they had a very long marriage.
They had a very close friendship as well as a close marriage. It was 35 years. She died in 54 of emphysema, and he was absolutely broken up by it. She was certainly his closest friend, and I suspect it's fair to say that their relationship was complex from the start, that it may be that he was bisexual, and it is true that, according to all the people who knew them, that early on in their marriage there was a miscarriage. And also true that all of the male companions, or at least many of them, who had enduring relationships with Porter were people whom she also liked. He was careful about that. She was careful to protect him as much as she could in those days, and because it was very difficult in those days to live the kind of life that he did.
And just how public was his homosexuality? Where did he show it? Where did he conceal it?
Well, The movie, which talks a little bit about it, is a little more blatant than in reality. He was much more discreet about it for the most part. He certainly didn't go to He didn't miss an opening night party to go for a tryst in Central Park. He would never do something as irresponsible or as unprofessional as that. He was, after all, a professional. He was very sophisticated, and he was very courtly and a very dignified person in ways. But that was a private life that he had, and it was separate from it, and he had to find his way through it, and he did, and he had the money to do it, of course.
Robert Kimball is with me. We're talking about Cole Porter. The lyrics of his songs, or at least about 100 of them, have been collected in a new book, Cole Porter, Selected Lyrics, as part of the American Poets Project series. What do you think? Is Cole Porter a poet in your book? We're going to listen to the music, hear the lyrics, look at the poetry of Cole Porter. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Here's Night and Day, maybe his most famous song, written in 1932. Here's Fred Astaire singing Night and Day. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
A voice within me keeps repeating you, 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 night and day. You are the one. Only you beneath the moon and under the sun. Whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling, where you are, I think of you. Night and day, day and night, why is it so that this longing for you follows wherever I go? In the roaring traffic's boom, in the silence of my lonely room, I think of you night and day.
It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Here's Ella Fitzgerald singing Cole Porter's Too Darn Hot, written in 1948. This song was from the musical Kiss Me, Kate, Cole Porter's perhaps his most famous musical. It ran for nearly 2.5 years on Broadway.
Fill the cup with my baby tonight. But I ain't up to my baby tonight, cause it's too darn hot. It's too darn hot.
We're talking about the great American songwriter Cole Porter and the poetry of his elegant, intelligent, frisky, witty, moving, sexual, all-American lyrics. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Is he still delightful, delicious, de-lovely for you? Does he rank as a great American poet? Can a popular lyricist also be a true poet? Is Cole Porter? 800-423-TALK is our number. I'm joined by Robert Kimball, editor of the new book, Cole Porter, Selected Lyrics, published by the Library of America in its American Poets Project series, right there with Edna St. Vincent Millay, Walt Whitman, Edgar Allan Poe, and a whole bunch more. You write, Robert Kimball, that the risque elegance of his songs, and you hear it in almost every single one, seemed a perfect complement to the boom times of the jazz age. But it was the Depression that really brought out the sort of great Cole Porter era. Talk to us about Cole Porter in his times.
It is ironic and sort of surprising that the greatest musical theater spokesman for the 1930s should be someone who is relatively unaffected by the Depression. Certainly not economically. He was able to sustain such losses as he had with relative ease, while other people suffered a great deal. I mean, after all, You're the Top, which cheered people up in the heart of the Depression. It was a song that gave people a sense of hope during the dimmest and darkest days of the American Depression. And he was able to capture some other qualities. He knew that everybody suffered in their love relationships, and everybody went through pain.
Sounds like we've lost Robert Kimball there for a moment at least. Perhaps we'll get him back in just a flash here. He's with us. Good. Robert Kimball, are you there?
I certainly am, Tom.
You blanked on me for a moment.
Oh, I didn't intend to do that.
I'm sure you didn't. You note that he may have been insulated himself from the problems, the economic problems of the Depression, but his His awareness, his feel for passion, its glory and its pain was something everybody could relate to.
Yes, certainly. And I think that he knew that, you know, the road to utopia, which many people thought was through the stock market and real estate and acquiring wealth, that wouldn't bring happiness. He knew that it didn't do that. And he told everybody in America that, you know, that side of the American dream was very misleading. And that you really have to do things like escape boredom, which preoccupied him his whole life, and develop a life that is interesting and surprising. And he loved that. And he loved to travel, and he loved to do different things, and he was able to do it. But he gave Americans this sense of optimism even during those difficult times.
Ebullience, at the same time, there's this world weariness, as you say, a kind of jaded take on affluence, on high society. He could look at the emotional relationships, their transient nature that everybody gets into, songs at the extremes of passion. You quote one here, "So taunt me and hurt me, deceive me, desert me, I'm yours till I die, so in love, so in love, so in love, my love am I." That's from?
Kiss Me, Kate.
Kiss Me, Kate. And the moods of loss that might follow you also point to, "So goodbye, dear, and amen. Here's hoping we meet now and then. It was great fun, but it was just one of those things.
One of those things.
Yeah.
Well, Deborah's certain, you know, that's a wonderful song, isn't it?
Oh, unbelievable.
Because, you know, it's all about these brief encounters that we all have. And they are fun, and then they're fleeting, and we go on to others.
And then they're gone, Cole Porter. And how many of these songs run in the interior jukeboxes that we all carry around? It's just unbelievable how deeply embedded he is in the American songbook. Let's begin to turn to our callers, if we may. Robert Kimball, Deborah's calling from Middletown, Connecticut. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Boy, I just love Cole Porter. You know, Fred Astaire and Cole Porter in my mind, that kind of period of, you know, glitzy Broadway, the fun of it all.
Oh, yeah.
But I have a thought that I recently took a diversity class, and I was studying about hip-hop.
Welcome to the world, Deborah. Welcome to the diverse world.
I was so struck by the expressiveness and the poetry of hip-hop, mm-hmm. and the way it captures the worldview of a particular culture. And, you know, the rhyming and all is very, sort of superficially, it's very simplistic. And I, as you were talking about Cole Porter, I started thinking, gee, you know, there's kind of a parallel here. Although, of course, he comes from a very narrow, cultural group. Still, there's this quality of it's a music of the times, and there's something about that regular rhythmic, rhyming type thing that. There's a similarity there.
You know, anyway. As counterintuitive as it may seem, I really think you're onto something there. You know, you've got so much of current events here. You've got a lot of sexuality here. You've got the rhymes that you just reach straight out for here. Robert Kimball, I don't know if you're a hip-hop guy, but do we have the original Jay-Z here in Cole Porter?
Well, in a sense, we do. In a way, he was a pioneer for hip-hop. You know, he opened doors for all writers who followed him by being more willing to tackle diverse subjects. And I think that the fact that he did that, songwriters all through the years have been able to, at least when they were aware of it, applaud him because he made it easier to be expressive in all areas. And I think he would have enjoyed hip-hop if he had been alive to hear it.
He certainly went up against taboos and occasionally got bitten for that. Remind us of the lyrics where Cole Porter just went further than American popular culture was willing to go with him.
Well, certainly one famous example of that is the song Love for Sale, which is a song about prostitution. And that song could not be performed on the radio for 25 years, at least sung on the radio. You could hear an instrumental version by Andre Castellanets right. or someone else, but not sung because people did not feel that was appropriate for a mass American audience. And that lasted from 1930 into the 50s. So that's an example, and a song we'll be hearing, I think, later has a line, so some get a kick from cocaine, and that had to come out because we're not supposed to talk about cocaine in 1934.
It was perfumes of Spain instead.
Yes, he wrote all the variants himself, reluctantly, but he had to do it.
I mean, interestingly, of course, a great Lena Horne version of Love for Sale. You write about how the context kind of had to be shifted. When this was on stage, it couldn't be a sort of a white prostitute. It got moved uptown. It got moved to the Cotton Club.
That's exactly right. Isn't that something? Yes, it was not okay at Rubens on 58th Street in mid-Manhattan, but up at the Cotton Club and having an African-American woman sing it was all right.
Did he get taken straight on for moral turpitude? Did people go after him, authorities or, Bible thumpers saying, we've got to get rid of Cole Porter? Or did he have enough common touch that he avoided that?
He was affected by the criticism. There's a song I hope we can play called A Tale of the Oyster, which critics said was a tasteless song about regurgitation. And they were so angry about the song that it had to be taken out of the show 50 Million Frenchmen after only a few weeks. And it was never published, or at least not until many, many, many years later. And he ran into this a lot. He wrote a song called But in the Morning No, which I think most people can imagine what that was about. And that song the recordings were pulled from the record stores because the double entendres were so obvious and so explicit that people were shocked.
I don't go riding in the morning. We've got The Tale of the Oyster, 1929, as you say, for 50 Million Frenchmen, sung here by Joan Morris. The song was, as you say, Robert Kimball, eventually dropped from the musical because audiences were offended by the lyrics.
After lunch, Mrs. H complains and says to her hostess, I've got such pains. I came to town on my yacht today, but I think I'd better hurry back to Oyster Bay. Scared little oyster. Off they go through the troubled tide, the yacht rolling madly from side to side. They're tossed about till that poor young oyster finds that it's time he should quit his cloister. Up comes the oyster.
Up comes the oyster. Okay, there's the elegant Mr. Porter with regurgitation as his subject. It hardly sounds like hip-hop, but it was just too much. People said, no, thank you, sir.
No, it's all done with such propriety and such elegance, like a Schubert art song, the whole thing. And then out of that, you catch this oyster coming back up.
Here it comes. And of course, society comes into it. The lyrics go on to say that the oyster felt well satisfied, that it had a chance to share in high society.
Yes, indeed. And this was one of the private party songs that he wrote in the 20s, and somehow it made its way into 50 Million Frenchmen, however, for just a few weeks. And it was the kind of song he wrote constantly to amuse his friends.
And the high society piece, interesting as well. I mean, that's where he lived. It's where he socialized. And yet, when you look through his lyrics, he's got such a sense of what's going on out in the world, such a sense that his popular references are still stand up today. The things he chose to refer to, are things we still talk about today.
Oh, so true. So many of them. Yes, even the ones that have gone are sort of iconic, have iconic resonance for us.
When he wrote about Mahatma Gandhi, that was a contemporary who became, of course, an all-time legend. I mean,
yes, he was leading the hunger marches in India at the time. And that's it. Well, Porter went around to his friends and said, what's your top experience? What do you rank as the top? And he did that to his friends, and he collected them, and he put them into this extraordinary song that we know.
Let me take a call from Topsfield, Massachusetts. Mark's on the line. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Yes. I'm the artistic director for a group called New England Light Opera here in the Boston area.
Oh, great.
And we did a Cole Porter review a couple of years ago. And in doing the research for that show, we actually read through about 300 of Porter's songs to put that show together. And it became very clear during that and then the audience response to the songs that truly it is Porter's lyrics that people respond to. That people remember the tunes for Gershwin and Rogers, but it's the lyrics for Porter that really draw people in.
What's the proof of the pudding there, Mark? How do you ascertain that that's where the joy is here?
Well, it became both in my own response and reading through all of those songs, that was certainly what the really memorable portion of all of that really was the lyrics. And in reading through, I would recognize all sorts of these lyrics, but not really remember the tunes for a lot of them. But also just in talking with people at the shows themselves, and when we would talk to people about the show, their lights would light up when the name of Cole Porter came up, and they would immediately start spewing off these various little bits of lyric. And having done a whole bunch of shows, and a number of them from the great American sort of songbook canon, that this was I've never seen anything like this in any of the other shows that we've done.
You want to hum them, but more than that, you want to remember what the words are because they're so much fun.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's the word that people always remember with them, is fun and sophisticated. Those are the two words that just came up over and over and over again from audience. And I would say he's certainly deserving of a poetry collection. I think of the 20th century American lyricist, he would be one of the top three there, Porter, Stephen Sondheim, and then also Ira Gershwin, I think would all be deserving of looking at their lyrics in a poetic context.
Bring them in. Robert Kimball, here's a light opera director. There's
yes.
a Gilbert and Sullivan sort of thread back in the
sure.
words of Porter here. Describe that for us.
Well, he was obviously fully cognizant of Gilbert and Sullivan, as he was of P.G. Wodehouse, as he was of Browning and Tennyson, as he was of Greek and Latin, as he was of history. All those references are part of his armor and what he does. And I think it's true that the lyrics are so dazzling, they're so brilliant, that what Mark is saying makes a lot of sense. Not everybody has the same problem with the music, Mark, but I think it is fair to say that the brilliance of the lyrics is just so almost blinding.
And yet, those tunes, I know I never get away from them. And we've got a caller speaking just to that. Kevin's calling from Orleans, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks. Well, yes, I think to answer your question, is he a poet? Mm. The lyrics are poetic and they're clever, but the melodies sometimes are fairly beautiful. So I think, separating the music from the lyrics, even Bob Dylan doesn't want to call himself a poet and say he's a songwriter and separate the music from the lyrics. It's a song, and it just seems like...
Let it be a song.
You're separating it in a way. You haven't just took 33 minutes to talk about the melodies.
Well, I tell you, I mean, you take out the lyrics and they're fun to have, but I agree, Kevin, Robert Kimball, I mean, you want to hear these in the music. I wonder how Cole Porter himself thought about it. Which came first for him, the tune or the lyrics? Did he do it together? What was his process?
Yeah, no, he worked on them together. He had an idea, or maybe a little part of a theme, and he usually started at both ends of the song and worked back to the middle, building like a bridge. And he always worked pretty much together, simultaneously. The music and the lyrics for him came together. And that's part of what makes his song so rich and extraordinary, I think, is that they are that way. You know, when you have a team, even as close a team as Rodgers and Hart or the Gershwins or Rodgers and Hammerstein, you have, two different sensibilities at work, and here you have one. And I think that enabled him to craft his songs in a very distinctive way.
When did he write? How did he write? Where?
When did he write? Well, he wrote mostly when he had quiet time at night. He wrote wherever he could be. If he was on a world cruise, he wrote, or on a ship, or at a spa, in a hotel. Of course, he lived in a hotel at the Waldorf for many, many years, and he tended to work at night, and he wrote so many poetic and extraordinary lyrics about the night. So, not surprisingly, he was there and absorbed all that. And what was your other question, Tom?
Just where and when, as I was struck in the biography of how much he traveled, how much he took from actually being out in the world. I mean, he used that money, and he really moved with it.
He traveled as long as he was physically able to. His terrible accident, which crushed his legs and necessitated over 30 operations, restricted his travel a good deal, but it did not stop him from traveling. He was traveling until his illnesses in the mid-50s became so debilitating that it was no longer possible for him to travel. But he was curious about the world, endlessly curious.
We'll talk about that end of Cole Porter's career. Love to hear from you as well. My guest is Robert Kimball. He's editor of Cole Porter Selected Lyrics, just out in the American Poets Project series. You can join our conversation, What Cole Porter Tune Gets You Humming, Whistling, Dancing, Laughing. Here's Dinah Washington singing Cole Porter's 1934, I Get a Kick Out of You, written for the musical Anything Goes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I should get a kick out of you. Some get a kick from champagne. I'm sure that if I took even one sip, that would bore me terrifically too. Yet I get a kick out of you.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're listening here to Sheryl Crow sing Cole Porter's 1935 song, Begin the Begin, this version from the 2004 movie, De Lovely.
It brings back a night of tropical splendor. It brings back a
talking about the great American songwriter Cole Porter and the poetry of his unparalleled lyrics. Robert Kimball is with us. He's editor of the new book, Cole Porter, Selected Lyrics. He's for 41 years been the artistic advisor to the estate of Cole Porter, editor of a number of books, Cole and the Complete Lyrics of Cole Porter. It's a great little volume right here with these unbelievable, wonderful lyrics that you just never get tired of. You can join the conversation. What do you make of Cole Porter? Are you a fool for Anything Goes, Night and Day, Too Darn Hot, Every Time We Say Goodbye? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Robert Kimball, a very different interpretation here with Sheryl Crow, but it's marvelous.
I think it's great. A lot of people have attacked it. But I think it's sort of like a jazz interpretation. She takes a slightly different tack on the melody and the harmony, but the rhythms are there, and I've defended this interpretation because I think it's really fine and very unusual. And it's also as fascinating to me to hear Dinah Washington's. I'd never heard that recording, but she takes liberties, too, with the music and the lyrics, I thought. You know, she changed the lyrics around a bit and did some changing in the music. So this is a tradition that we have had in music, and if it's done well, it's wonderful.
It's kind of irresistible when the substructure is so strong, the singer can dance with it and take it in new directions, and it's still stands right there. I love
that. That's well said.
The kind of a mystery. Begin the Begin always had this aura of mystery around it. You write that it may have been inspired by his travels as well. What?
Well, it certainly was. It certainly was. He was inspired by a range of things. It began in hearing some sort of a tune in a nightclub in Paris, and it related to, you know, dancers from Martinique performing it there. And then when he's on the world cruise in 1935 at work on the show Jubilee, he goes past an island in the Dutch East Indies, not too far from East Timor, which is so much in the news, and he hears a native dance, and that becomes the underlying theme of this extraordinary song about lost love and remembering and not wanting to forget, yet wanting to forget your past love. It's one of the greatest songs ever written, I think.
And how many couples have danced to that? And I also love from that neck of the woods, that part of the world, it's delightful, delicious, it's the lovely, may have been inspired by the pleasure of eating a mangosteen on the island of Java. Mangosteen's got to be number one and maybe the sexiest fruit on earth. I had no idea, but I love to think of it still lovely as inspired by that.
Well, there's the other theory, and Porter said it too, of seeing Rio Harbor in the dawn. And we'll never know which it was. It may have been both.
Both pretty great pleasures.
Yes.
Lisa's calling from Waterloo, Iowa. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hello. Any Cole Porter conversation always makes me think of my junior year of high school, 1991. We had auditioned and cast to do Anything Goes as our fall musical.
In 1991,
Yes, and the school board got wind of that, told us it was too racy, and we canceled the production.
1934 production that couldn't be done in 1990. What did they object to in particular, Lisa?
I believe just general content.
Wow.
I'm sorry.
Racy is the word I remember.
That's amazing.
It must have been the song lyrics. It couldn't have been the book, but it had to have been those racy lyrics of Porter's, you know? That's quite. Where'd you go to school, Lisa?
A small town in northeast Iowa.
Wow.
What community?
It was LaPorte City.
Okay. Well, I think Porter would have been amused by that, too, actually.
Yeah.
I think he would have been.
Yeah. We really were. And actually, we ended up doing Little Shop of Horrors instead.
Right,
which I
right.
found no less racy.
Yeah, right.
No, it's a little scarier, but less racy.
Right. Bring on the horror. Out with Cole Porter. Too racy after all those years. That's amazing.
Lisa, thanks for calling. Wonderful. Well, don't give up on the show. If you ever get a chance, do it again.
Yeah, do it now. Let's take another call from Concord, Massachusetts. Dick's on the line. Hi, Dick. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'd like you to confirm or deny a little bit of trivia.
Okay.
My understanding is when Porter was in Yale, he was the only student ever allowed to have a piano in his room.
College trivia time. Robert Kimball, confirm or deny?
Boy, I having known that university for so many decades, I really can't confirm or deny that. I do think that he was considered eccentric even then, and that he did have a piano, and it may have been very, very unusual, and it may be that people had never seen it before, but it's a good thing he had the piano, because look what it led to.
Well, he was certainly writing like crazy while he was there. I mean, he was making a name in that environment, a big name.
Oh, yeah, no, and he had the most expensive room on campus. They used to publish the room prices in the Yale Daily News, and in his senior year, he had the most expensive room.
Always living large. Dick, thanks for your call.
Yes.
let's get a call from Ridgeland, South Carolina. Claudia's on the line. Hi, Claudia. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm eclectic in my music. Mm-hmm. I like it all as long as it doesn't offend me.
Mm-hmm.
Cole Porter has never offended me. I love the music, the performers, and the words. And I don't hear anybody anymore.
Who touches you that way? When does he take you back to? Does it take you back to childhood, Claudia?
Yes. Although my voice may sound one way, I am 62.
Mm-hmm.
And I started listening in the 50s, probably in the 40s, but I remember the 50s quite well.
And does he take you to love? Does he take you to elegance? Does he take you to what? Wit or
I lived in the elegance, the sophistication, the joy.
Yeah,
the music is so joyful; it's unbelievable. But although I think he wrote poetically, he is first and foremost a great composer of music that touches the heart and the soul.
It does indeed, and keeps right on touching. Claudia, thanks very much for your call. Let me get another from New Haven, Connecticut. Bruce is on the line. Hi, Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was thinking this a few years ago when I listened to You're the Top, which is just such a great song.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember in college, a poetry teacher talking about this theme of poetry taught that in a freshman year poetry class. But, it occurred to me that this was really his sort of somewhat hidden way of talking about his sexuality. You know, if you're the bottom, I'm the bottom.
Who's on top? Is that, oh my gosh.
Yeah, and I always thought this was his way of talking about his own gay sex.
About his homosexuality? Well, Robert
Possible.
Kimball, how about it?
It's a possibility. The songs work on so many levels. I think that's quite an interesting observation, and I think probably valid.
Though you write, you hear it mainly as a kind of a pep song for the Depression when people needed some cheering up.
When you say to me, baby, I'm the bottom, you're the top, well, maybe they're part of a bathing suit. I don't know. You can have fun with the song in any way, number of ways. But I think what you say is fascinating.
You're a Waldorf salad. You're a Berlin ballad. You're a baby grand of a lady and gent. You're an old Dutch master. You're Mr. Astor. You're Pepsodent. You're romance. You're the steps of Russia. You're the pants on a Roxy Usher. I mean, it's just, it doesn't quit.
It's the juxtaposition of the legendary things with the commonplace things of the day that makes it so fabulous.
I want to hear another interpreter here. Your favorite, I think, as I read you, Robert Kimball. Let's listen for a moment to Bobby Short singing At Long Last Love, written in 1938 for the show You Never Know. Porter's thought to have composed this song while lying on the ground after the horse riding accident you referred to earlier. We'll talk about that at Long Last Love.
Is it an earthquake or simply a shock? Is it the good turtle soup or merely the mock? Is it a cocktail, this feeling of joy? Or is what I feel the real McCoy? Have I the right hunch, or have I the wrong? Will it be Bach that I hear, or just a Cole Porter song? Is it a fancy?
Bobby Short singing At Long Last Love. Now, I know it's not funny. Cole Porter here at the beginning of some serious health problems, but did he really write a song like that after being thrown from a horse and lying on the ground? If he did, he's another species from me.
Well, he certainly didn't start the song when that happened, but he said to interviewers that while he was lying on the ground waiting for help and in such pain, that he worked on the song. I mean, listen to that opening line. Is it an earthquake or simply a shock? What has happened to this man? His life is changed forever. This is a terrible, terrible accident. He was nearly killed.
And that would have been, let's see, what year? He was at Long Island's Piping Rock Club in 1937.
Think of 37. Jerome Kern suffers a near-fatal heart attack. George Gershwin dies that year in July, and Cole Porter has this terrible accident all in the same year.
The doctors wanted to amputate both of his legs. His mother, Kate, who had played a huge role in his life, and his wife, Linda, refused, convinced that would kill him, but he never recovered. Years of and dozens of operations over a couple of decades followed.
He was in intense pain. People who worked with him said he was simply courageous and heroic and that he could work on going through what he did, and he continued writing for 20 years in this terrible shape physically.
When did he finally stop writing, and why?
He stopped writing when his right leg was amputated in the spring of 1958. His last song was called Wouldn't It Be Fun Not to Be Famous, which is an ironic last song. And when the amputation occurred, he stopped writing. He barely went to the piano, but he would not write and did not write another song. That was the end.
Died in 1964 in Santa Monica, California.
That's right. His mother and his wife were right. They knew him.
If he lost
that, it would kill him.
And eventually, it certainly killed his songwriting right there. John's calling from Stonington, Connecticut. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I just wanted to talk about how Cole Porter's music kind of grew on me and stayed with me over the years. And I think about it a lot when I listen to Ella Fitzgerald, who's my gold standard for interpretation of Cole Porter. But I think about, for example, in junior high school, listening to Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons doing a version of Under My Skin. Mm. And, of course, I didn't know anything about Cole Porter, and I thought they invented that song.
Right.
And it was wonderful as the years went by to start listening to these songs and to realize where they came from and to realize that somebody like the Four Seasons could remake those songs, and they were still worth doing and still wonderful songs.
And isn't it amazing, John, that so many could come from the pen of one man? It's just astonishing. 800 plus and more than 100, or about 100 right here. John, thanks for your call. Let me get one more from Nashville. Elise is on the line. Hi, Elise. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I called for one to tell you that I have a Cole Porter tattoo on my arm.
Oh, what's it look like?
I'm a big fan. Well, it's the last two measures of Let's Misbehave.
Ah.
And it has the staff with the music on it, which begins and ends with a rest, so it's nice and symmetrical.
Oh, yeah.
And then it has the words Let's Misbehave. I get more comments and compliments on it than just about anything.
I bet you do.
I get my tattoos, and I can let people know about Cole Porter. A lot of people don't know they know him. And when you tell them about a song or two, they go, oh, yeah, that guy.
Of course.
And I guess the other thing I wanted to ask was, in addition to the sexual taboos,
mm-hmm.
And I know you just had a gentleman on that was asking about the top and bottom issue, I find him incredibly kinky. He's got lines. He's got his daddy song, My Heart Belongs to Daddy. He's got lines about being, you know, love for sale, only slightly soiled,
right.
The cocaine that you mentioned,
right.
The nudist parties in Anything Goes.
Hey, he wasn't afraid of the edges at all. Mary Martin made her claim to fame singing My Heart Belongs to Daddy, doing a kind of strip tease.
Yes, and things like bears have love affairs and even camels were merely mammals, let's misbehave, little bestiality. I'm kind of curious about whether there's any evidence that in his own, that some of this, whether any of this was autobiographical, whether he was as kinky as he sounds, not just...
At least with your great Let's Behave tattoo, we'll pick it straight up. Let's Misbehave. When Adam won Eve's hand, he wouldn't stand for teasing in Let's Misbehave. He writes, Robert Campbell, Kimball, is this Cole Porter's life or imagination?
It's a part of his imagination, to be sure. And he did love animals. He could, in the beginning of his career, he wrote songs about them all the time, you know. He just did it, and he loved that. He had a playful imagination. Remember, he grew up in Peru, which was the home of the circus.
Peru, India,
Peru, Indiana was where all
Indiana,
the winter quarters of many of the major circuses in America. So he was surrounded by that life from the time he was a small child. So he certainly absorbed that, and yes, his imagination roamed freely, and I think what we've heard today has been just fascinating for me to hear. I'm delighted with it all.
Give us your last advice. Here's a book full of lyrics. How do you suggest we read it? Do we sit down and read it as poetry neat, or do we turn on the music and sing along?
You can do it any way you like. Start in the back, start in the middle, read, pick up one you know, pick up things you don't know. Yeah, it's meant to be a distillation of his career, and I tried for a representation of what I thought was his best and most interesting work, and they're always, I can second-guess myself as much as anybody can second-guess me.
Do it any way you like. That sounds like a Cole Porter sentiment. We'll go out on it. Robert Kimball, it's been wonderful having you.
Oh,
thank
Tom,
you very
Tom,
much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed this.
Robert Kimball, editor of the new Cole Porter Selected Lyrics. It is really a treat. We go out with the voice and words of Cole Porter himself singing Anything Goes, written in 1934 for the show of the same name, tells people it's okay to be yourself. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
When you hear that Lady Mendel standing up, now does a handspring landing up on her toes. Anything goes. Just think of those shocks you've got, and those knocks you've got, and those blues you've got from those news you've got, and those pains you've got, if any brains you've got from those little radios. So Mrs. R, with all her trimmings, can broadcast a bit from Simmons, 'cause Franklin knows anything goes.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.